wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Denise Morris is the producer of today's program. We at the Old Mole are dedicated to offering the socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and LGBTQ positive analysis of culture, politics, and current events. Today in our program, we welcome new Old Mole Chelsea Ratzliff. She'll be talking with Tara Hopebringer on Hopebringer's new play, Ways of Trying, a solo show about queer love and liberation with original music. A group of progressive members of Congress have mobilized to oppose any expansion of federal laws to combat far-right extremism in the aftermath of the January 6th siege on the Capitol. In their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker discuss the charges brought to so far against those who participated in the siege and why it's so difficult to find ways of characterizing those actions. Getting things underway today, Bill Resnick interviews newly elected Representative Con Pham, Oregon Assembly District 46. She's been an activist leader of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance that developed its proposal, Oregon Needs a Green New Deal, and convened the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, now gathering strength. They'll be discussing the program she's bringing to the legislature, especially around clean renewable sun and wind locally produced energy, and how to win in the Oregon legislature and nationally, which requires movements pressing the Democratic majority to take action. Bill?
Hi, State Representative Con Pham. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Con Pham has been a community organizer. She's advocated with the Asia-Pacific American Network of Oregon. She's directed the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, where she worked to develop its proposal titled Oregon Needs a Green New Deal. And recently, the Just Transition Alliance established and convened the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, with over 60 sponsoring organizations. For me, the Clean Energy Campaign is a great step forward toward the vitally needed transformation of Oregon's, indeed the planet's, energy system. And just recently, she was elected to the Oregon Legislature representing District 46, which stretches across northeast and southeast Portland. Mount Tabor is about in the middle of it. It's a very diverse district. So, Representative Con Pham, tell us about the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, why it was organized, its goals, and the legislation now being considered by the Oregon Legislature.
Yes, thank you for asking. Well, we know that 2020 has brought so many hardships for Oregon. We have people who are struggling to pay their bills and keep wildfire smoke out of their homes. People who have lost their income due to COVID and the climate crisis. So our goal with this Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign was to how can we reduce energy bills and also support the home upgrades that families need so that they can stay healthy, and also how can we create good jobs? We know that the clean energy economy is growing, that we need to make this transition. How do we make sure that these investments, as we're pushing utilities and other sectors to move to renewable energy, how do we make sure that they're also investing in community-based renewable energy projects that will create family wage jobs all across Oregon, particularly in rural communities that have been underinvested for many years? I'm happy to talk a little bit more about each of the bills.
Sure.
So the first bill is House Bill 2475, and that's the Energy Affordability Bill, and that's going to decrease utility costs for families who are already struggling in the economic recession by establishing a low-income utility rate class so that families don't have to choose between keeping their homes warm in the winter and putting food on the table. And the second bill is the Healthy Homes Bill, which is House Bill 2842, and that will support home upgrades to help improve the health of families across Oregon. We know that with the wildfires, many of our families are stuck in the homes for many weeks during the wildfire season, and without really good seal and insulation, you know, families' health is really being impacted. And so this will both build energy efficiency while also improving family health. And the third bill that's part of the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign is the 100% Clean Energy for All Bill, or House Bill 2995. And that'll create good, well-paying local jobs in the renewable energy sector and reduce pollution by achieving 100% renewable energy as soon as possible.
That's a great set of bills. I'm most interested in build out of local energy, along with so many other people in the energy democracy movement. We've concluded that local build-out, that is community energy, is central to stopping global warming and the catastrophe that's inevitable, say the climate scientists, unless we humans mobilize and take sweeping action soon. That's because local energy can be built out quickly and cheaply by any contractor who can build a home or rehab a kitchen using off-the-shelf sun and wind technologies. In addition, local energy production is far more resilient and reliable than the investor-owned utility systems and their big grids. Because the sun shines everywhere, the winds blow everywhere, and energy storage is getting much less expensive, locally produced energy using off-the-shelf technology can be quickly repaired, whereas big grid energy coming from hundreds and thousands of miles away, it's only as reliable as its most vulnerable pylons. Some of the recent great wildfires of California and Oregon have been caused by downed power lines, and near all of the fires have burned through and destroyed great stretches of grid in places difficult to access by repair crews. So, Tan Pham, tell us about the local build-out envisioned in those bills that the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign is supporting for legislative enactment this year. To what extent can local build-out be achieved if the bills are enacted?
Yeah, exactly. I think this set of bills is really about creating pathways for community-based energy projects, particularly in the 100% Clean Energy for All bill. So this bill can't be everything that we want, but it will pave the way for more clean energy development that creates good local jobs so that people in communities across Oregon can see that this works, that the transition to renewable energy brings concrete, immediate benefits and investments to their families and their communities. That's one of the things I'm most excited about, is that we're defining we don't want to just have, you know, renewable energy that's still owned and monopolized by just a few corporations, but we are defining what does community-based energy look like, renewable energy look like, and making sure that we're setting really clear definitions so that it has to be a certain distance from communities, not so far away that, as you pointed out, so that is a key resilience strategy, so that it's close to where people are using it and it's offering the same economic benefits and kind of democratizing the economic benefits so that we have community groups. Like here in Portland, we have groups like Verde who are owning and trying to get community ownership of these solar projects so that communities can directly benefit from the cost savings that come from renewable energy.
How do you see local community energy being run and organized in any locality? Could public agencies construct the local installations and operate them, as well as work with local organizations like Verde and the Cully District to expand the network, and also work these public agencies with all the groups and movements advocating and fighting for alternative electrified transport, alternative agriculture, energy conservations, all the groups in any community that in one way or another are working to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That has to happen around the world, in fact, in all places of human habitation. And it has to happen locally because our work is local, our homes are local, our schools, gyms, restaurants, all, of course, local. And that local build-out of clean energy across the planet, especially in what's called developed countries, will be necessary to sufficiently reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, I think that's the long-term vision that we are moving towards. We do need to have, I think you mentioned a state agency or, you know, public funds going towards this in a much more massive scale than we can do in the nonprofit sector. But this is a way to start towards that path and show that they're, like you said, demonstration projects, and this will create the financial incentive because utilities will be required to get a certain percentage of their renewable energy from community-based renewable energy. Some of it will obviously have to come from utility scale projects, but we want to be able to actually provide the capital financing that you need up front by mandating that utilities need to get. I don't know the exact percentage, it's still being somewhat negotiated, but you know, even something like a 4% and going up to 8% requirement for community-based renewable energy projects would be a huge incentive so that community-based groups like Verde or in other parts of the state, in Lake County, in Southern Oregon, could actually know that they're guaranteed a buyer for their community-based renewable energy.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole on Cable Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Tom Pham, a community organizer, one of the authors of Oregon Needs a Green New Deal, a policy paper from the Just Transition Alliance, and she's one of the founders of the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. She was just elected to the legislature and is working with other legislators to pass a legislative package, which would, as she discussed, build out clean energy, lower energy bills, weatherize the built environment, also create a lot of good jobs, and generate a measure of climate justice. So ConFam and other states, the big electric utilities, the people who send the bills, they've been strenuously resisting individuals or communities building out their own energy supplies, because every solar panel and wind turbine erected locally by individuals or government or community organizations, that means lost customers to the big utilities. And in fact, if that continued and continued long enough, the company would in fact go into bankruptcy. So they've resisted much in most of the country. On the other hand, though, the big utilities could reinvent themselves. They certainly wouldn't be as big and profitable for their executives. They still offer good local work and saving the planet, a noble endeavor, maybe not very profitable in the short run. ConFam, how are PGE, Pacific Power, and the others, how are they responding to the Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign and the legislative package?
I'm really happy to report that we do have the big utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp, who are actively participating, and they're in our policy work group meetings. Workshopping the specific details. It is important to have them at the table because they are so critical to energy generation in our current system. So I really want to give props to the amazing coalition, particularly Verde, but also the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, which is a statewide alliance of frontline-led organizations across the state of Oregon who are coming together to advance the vision for a just transition. And that's the work that they've been doing over years, really, to build relationships with utilities and to develop this vision, this policy. I used to work at the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, where we did a statewide listening tour last summer and went to communities across the state, from Klamath County to Medford and Coos Bay, Eugene and Portland, to talk to frontline communities. That means Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities, as well as low-income rural communities, to talk about what are the biggest challenges facing them and what is their vision for Oregon in 2030. And so it was really that community visioning process that led to one of the priorities that came out. It was overlapping with the wildfire season. One of the priorities that came out was, how do we achieve 100% renewable energy that's community controlled? So, you know, we know that utilities are already making voluntary commitments to shift to 100% renewable energy. They can do it at utility scale. They still see a pathway for their business model to continue. So they're actually seeing a lot of reasons to support this, and that it can both meet their economic goals, but as well as their moral visions. I think PGE in particular has shown a lot of leadership setting clear targets for when they want to move to 100% renewable energy. And this mandate can actually just provide some of the legal backing to kind of just really force some of those changes more quickly.
I hope the collaboration continues and they come to envision a very different role for themselves in a local network energy system.
Well, we know that utilities can't do it on their own, and that's why we're so committed to the statewide organizing. So having groups and community groups that are rooted in their localities, like Rogue Climate, which has been working for many years in the Rogue Valley to build a powerful grassroots base. I mean, we know that no one is going to do this alone. Legislators alone can't do it. Communities can't do it. But by building a powerful grassroots movement that's going to push legislators and keep the political pressure on, you know, that'll make sure that utilities can see the benefit of participating rather than having to fight something that is clearly gonna pass with the voters.
That's a great way to end this interview. How do we enact the legislation, build out community energy, and transform the utilities?
We definitely need everybody's support. So I do want to encourage anybody listening who's interested in supporting to sign up at our website. It's cleanenergyoregon.org. And you can find out more about the bills and also find out more about the hearings and testimony and how you can sign up to give testimony and how you can support.
Representative Comfam, thanks a lot for talking to us today. The Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign has a lot of local sponsors, including 350.org, the Portland Sunrise Movement, and over 60 others. These represent thousands of people in this state. And as they grow, as all the movements grow with more of us getting active, they will create a nucleus for the formation of a massive movement likely to come. Because people here in the United States and around the world are coming to understand the gravity of global warming. And when the masses of people lead, the leaders will follow, and the corporate elites, they'll be forced to surrender. Confam, keep up the good work as the voice of the movements in Salem. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Please, again, visit cleanenergyoregon.org if you want to learn more and get involved.
This is KBOO Portland. You are tuned into the Old Mole Variety Hour. The song was Here Comes the Sun by a group called The Beatles. Before that, you heard Bill Resnick talking with newly elected Oregon Representative Confam, among other things, advocating for sun as a renewable energy source. Now Chelsea Ratzliff interviews playwright Tara Holtbringer on Holtbringer's new play, Ways of Trying. It's a solo show about queer love and liberation with original music. This project is a selection of Fertile Ground Festival 2021 and will premiere on February 3rd at 7 p.m. Ways of Trying is deeply personal yet very relatable. It responds to current events such as the pandemic and the uprising for racial justice and shows that queerness is transformative for the self and society.
Chelsea Ratzliff here for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm speaking today with Tara Holtbringer. Tara is a writer, director, musician, performer, and teaching artist at Northwest Children's Theater. They have recently performed with Bag and Baggage and Milagro Theater. Tara is a writer and performer in their upcoming play, Ways of Trying, with direction from Cassie Greer, Kate Mura, and Georgina Escobar. Ways of Trying is a solo show about queerness, community, and liberation, and is part of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Works. The play will premiere on February 3rd, 2021, and will be available to view until February 15th. Welcome to KBOO, Tara. We're excited to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Chelsea. It's great to be here.
In ways of trying, you use live looping to give the audience the impression of circularity, of returning, of continuing to try, for example, to be accepted in childhood, trying to be okay during a pandemic, and trying to be an ally for liberation during an uprising. Talk about what inspired the title and substance of this piece and what you hope viewers will glean from it.
Ways of Trying started as a series of poems that explore different ways of seeking love, belonging, and acceptance as a queer person. And trying is key because we are all constantly shifting, adapting, and practicing. It's not a journey to perfection, but is a path or many paths to ourselves. Ways of Trying is about growing into queer sexuality and gender nonconformity, questioning power and privilege, and reclaiming joy in riot. I want to connect my personal life experiences with the communal struggle for liberation for all people. And so I explore reverberations between the uprising for racial justice and oppressive societal conditioning and my own vulnerable histories of love and heartbreak. And as I leaned into this piece, a lot of questions came up that I tried to address, like how do my privileges interact with these themes, and what is originality, and what makes my story unique, and what makes my story very relatable and universal. I hope that my audience recognizes that all of us are impacted, though in very different ways, by racism, capitalism, and the cis-heteropatriarchy. And I hope that they feel the freedom to question and to break rules and conventions. I want to give the audience permission to pursue their own self-liberation.
How does the play address the difference between performative activism and real accountability and impact, particularly when we think about the often kind of performative nature of land acknowledgement statements?
In this piece, I included a section where I acknowledge my privileges as a white, abled person, and then challenge myself to go deeper, to go beyond the surface where a lot of performative activism ends, to ask myself what anti-racist action and accountability for harm looks like in my life. And I certainly struggle with the fear that this is simply performative. It is a performance, of course, but it also reflects my real life. So being accountable to my community and to the movement means going beyond words into meaningful action, or even leaving the words out of it entirely, but to just acting when and where we are able to humbly work for justice. I struggle somewhat with having the privilege and the platform of having this show, and it feels like the right thing for me to do to acknowledge and to grapple with those complexities in the piece itself. I believe that land acknowledgements are very important, but they can be hollow and rote when they're not done with real substance. They can just be a new part of politically correct culture. Acknowledgement is nothing without addressing personal complicity and active steps to decolonize and support Indigenous sovereignty.
You establish that the setting of the piece in Ways of Trying is Riot Day, and you reference the Stonewall Riots of 1969, an uprising led by Black trans women protesting the police raid of the Stonewall Inn in New York when liquor licenses were not given to gay establishments. Can you talk about the lessons of the Stonewall Riots and the central role of Black trans women?
Well, first of all, Riot Day is a fictional holiday that I created for this show. One that celebrates all that is subversive, transformative, and queer. And I bring up the Stonewall Riots because they were fundamental in shifting the gay rights movements from assimilation to liberation. Many of the rights and privileges that gay people have nowadays are owed to the work and passion of Black and Brown trans women who led those riots, which are a part of movement work, but are also a moment of joy. Women like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera led riots against the police, the carceral state, the entire patriarchy, and all of those forces are intertwined and terribly racist and sexist and anti-gay. And riots do not just dissent to those systems, they interrupt them. And to be clear, rioting is a tactic, and so context is very important. When white supremacists riot, that's bad. But when oppressed people take direct action to meet their needs and to take back power, that is good, or it can be good. It's a very complex situation. And many people don't like riots as a tactic, no matter who does it. And most people didn't approve of the Stonewall riots, especially as they were happening. But history shows that those riots were very effective and powerful, and that riots and strikes and similar sort of direct actions can be very effective. Black trans women are still leading revolutionary movements, and they need our support because they are often targets of violence.
The Stonewall riots really operated as a de facto community center for gay youth who were rendered homeless by familial and institutional rejection and who had taken refuge in these places when they didn't have anywhere else to go. And so we also see that riots are really central to survival in many communities, unlike the insurrection we saw on the 6th.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. There is a really important aspect to the gay community, which is chosen family. And a lot of times people are rejected by their immediate or their biological families. And the gay community being able to take care of each other and to support each other with mutual aid, with community building, is so important. And yes, those sort of riots are really life-giving, as opposed to, like you said, the recent insurrectionist attempt.
While a solo performance, Ways of Trying includes several characters, including the musician, the femme, and my personal favorite, the cat. I was so moved by your performance of multiple identities contained in a single body as they interact with one another. What is at stake in allowing heteronormativity to go unchecked? And what is the significance of queer and trans resistance? And what kinds of visions do you see them casting for human sexuality and identity?
Heteronormativity is an extremely limited worldview. It supports binary thinking, conformity, labels, and assumptions. It's a part of the capitalist system that reduces human capacity and potential to what they can consume and produce. Forcing someone to be just one way is limiting at best and devastating at worst. Queer and trans resistance is more than just surviving in a heterosexual world. It is embracing exploration and discovery. It's about our beautiful uniqueness and thriving in the bodies and relationships and communities that we are in. Not necessarily what we were born into, but shining in who we are, which is constantly evolving. With those multiple characters that emerge in the show represent different facets of myself. And all of us are very multifaceted. And all of us are changing and evolving over time. And gender and sexuality in particular are aspects of ourselves that are fluid and that change over time. And that really goes for everyone, not just people who identify as queer. That evolution is a part of all of us. And so queer liberation is also for all people. It is expansive and it is opening for all people. Queer liberation may be a threat to heteronormativity, but it is not a threat to heterosexuals. Being queer or gay looks a million different ways. There's no one way to experience sexuality. And so the joy and the freedom is in finding and feeling accepted as your unique gender and sexual identity. And that includes straight people. That includes people who are asexual. That includes everyone on all phases of the spectrum, or however you like to think about it.
Your play returns again and again to themes of shame and pride. At one point, your character says, "Shame doesn't have a place to pass through. It just sticks like slug slime on your fingers." How do you see shame working as a mechanism of social control and dominant narratives about sexuality?
Shame is often picked up culturally and carried internally. There are so many messages about shame and the body, shame and sex, shame and being different. It makes people try desperately to look or to act a certain way or to hide things about ourselves. And it often leads to a lot of unhappiness and self-hatred. Sexuality is a powerful and beautiful thing, and deeply personal and intimate. Controlling sexuality has always been a tool of the patriarchy and a way to consolidate power with cis men and with the state. In dominant narratives, we see shame used against people who are promiscuous, but also against people who don't have sex, people who have sex too young or too old, and people who deviate from narrowly defined heterosexual fertile marriages. And that all becomes insidiously internalized.
What does pride mean in the context of the play, and what do you see as its transformative power more broadly, especially when we recognize that sexuality has been used as a tool of control?
I use pride to describe a feeling that is the opposite of shame, but also use it as a reference to celebrations of gay pride. Radical pride is an acceptance of who you are at the root and rejecting the notion that it should be hidden or changed. I reject heteronormalcy, but also the idea that there is one right or acceptable way to be queer. And I reject corporate pinkwashing, especially during pride festivals or performing support for gay rights to promote goods or to distract from oppression and violence. Pride is transformative when it embraces and celebrates diversity and community because it exists, not because it can be commodified. Pride is self-love. And transformation really starts with the self, and then it can move into personal relationships and then into the greater community. But it really starts with self-love and self-acceptance and not trying to change or to morph who we are into what we think we should be, but celebrating the way that we are and the way that we express our love.
In Ways of Trying, you begin with an invocation and end with a spell in which you command yourself, the audience, or maybe the inner you and all of us to, quote, live in disobedience. Why is it important to practice disobedience in our inner lives and to celebrate the spirit of writing, particularly right now?
Yes, we start with the self and start with our inner lives. We can abolish the cop in our heads. But really, disobedience is a practice that goes beyond our inner lives. We have some laws that are unethical. So should we obey them? We have laws that are enforced differently for different races and classes. We have police and prison systems that have evolved from slavery to profit on the exploitation of labor and bodies, particularly of Black, Indigenous, and other people of color. But disobedience to me means following an ethical compass. It means dissent against oppression and a refusal to cooperate. It means anarchy, not as in chaos, but as in a free society without a state authority. And to celebrate rights, particularly in our current context, is to recognize that there are many societal injustices, and they may change in administration, but not in fundamental nature. And that's where we need real changes. We need real upheavals in the oppressions that affect us all, but particularly affect people of color and people who are disabled. A chant that I've heard in the streets this summer is, "This is not a riot, it's a revolution." And I think that speaks to the fact that the police will call even a peaceful vigil a riot in order to justify brutality and chemical warfare. And that is a real misuse of power. Not everything is a riot. Being out in the streets is not inherently a riot. But riots are a potential tool of the revolution. Just one tool in the toolbox, but they can be very useful. And I want to challenge how often they are viewed and demonized.
Thank you so much, Tara. Again, Tara Hopebringer here. Their play premieres on February 3rd, 2021, Ways of Trying. Tara, how can people view your play?
Well, this is a part of the Fertile Ground Festival of New Works, which is an 11-day festival of new works in theater, dance, multimedia, film. This year, it is all digital and it is all free. My show has its premiere on February 3rd at 7 p.m. And you can find it at the Fertile Ground Festival Facebook page, facebook.com/Fertile Ground Festival/video. And after its premiere, it will also be available on YouTube under the Fertile Ground Festival YouTube page. And that will be available through February 15th for on-demand viewing at any time.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. The music you just heard was by the playwright and is entitled Beyond the Empire. The play, once again, is called Ways of Trying. In the aftermath of the assault on the Capitol on January 6th, a number of leading Democrats have called for expansion of domestic surveillance and anti-terrorism laws in response to threats from the far right. Last week, 9 progressive Congress members submitted a formal letter of opposition to those lawmakers who are calling for more restrictive laws. In their Left on the Law segment, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talk about why it's important to join this opposition to the expansion of federal laws in response to white supremacists and other right-wing groups. Jan and Mike also discuss the charges brought so far against those participating in the January 6th siege of the Capitol and difficulties in how we even characterize these actions.
In the aftermath of the assault on the Capitol on January 6, a number of leading Democrats have called for expansion of domestic surveillance and anti-terrorism laws. Mike, let's start today with the charges so far against those participating in the riot, and then to the larger questions around these calls among Democrats for more restrictive federal laws in response to the threats by the far right. To start with, does it matter what we call the rioters? There has been a debate in the left as well about how to characterize this siege on the Capitol.
Well, it's tricky because, as usual, when there's a large number of people acting, the range of motives was vast. I mean, there are people there who were scheming and had been for weeks and wanted to make a serious move and occupy the Capitol if Trump was not given the presidency they believed was rightfully his. And there are other people who sort of vaguely thought that, who wanted to be in the mix. You know, so it's impossible to sort out with any real accuracy everyone's motives.
Well, what have been the charges so far and the complaint that the FBI has held back and there have been some constraints on charges, too few charges in many cases?
Well, as of a couple of days ago, as of January 26th, there was 147 people charged. And the charges were a mix of disorderly conduct, of knowingly entering, remaining in a restricted building. And some people were charged with knowingly engaging in disorderly, disruptive conduct with a dangerous weapon, with injuring property, injuring architectural features, with violent entry, disorderly conduct, all that mix of charges, which is pretty accurate.
That have various criminal penalties.
Yes.
Attached to them that would be under federal law.
Yeah, D.C. is not under state law. It's under basically the jurisdiction of the U.S. government.
Would federal penalties for those kinds of criminal charges be much different from state penalty?
Not much different, no. And they are investigating, and we don't know yet what will come of the charges against people who we know were involved with hurling fire extinguishers, and there could even be murder charges brought. There could certainly be manslaughter charges brought. They're now still sifting through the identification of who was what, because it was a very well-recorded event. I'm sure there'll be more charges later.
Well, I think the area of concern and controversy center at the level of charges and prosecution of cases involves these more political charges of sedition, insurrection, conspiracy charges against organizations like Proud Boys and Three Percenters. What about those charges? Can you speak to those categories? Some of them are kind of rhetorical invectives, but others have real legal meaning.
Yeah, those charges that deal with one's intent, with one's political views, are always bad. They were first done, as far as I know, in 1917 and 1918, when opposition to World War I was criminalized. And any action, any disparagement of the government for entering the war or any effort to slow down any of the economic activity underlying the war was criminalized. And of course, all kinds of people who were opposed.
Under sedition charges?
Yeah, there was an Espionage Act and sedition laws passed that were the subject of intense litigation. Hundreds of people were actually rounded up, prosecuted, and either deported or sent to prison for opposing the war or supporting those who did oppose the war. Eugene Debs went to prison because of opposition to the war and these espionage and sedition acts, and they gave birth to some of the most articulate First Amendment defenses, always done by dissenters, not by the majority, of appeals from convictions for sedition or espionage under these new laws.
So since 9/11 and the Patriot Act, much of the discourse and the federal responses to political violence have been directed toward foreign groups identified as terrorists. And could you give your take on this shift from focusing on foreign terrorists to now this call for identifying the far right as domestic terrorists, and Nancy Pelosi even asking for something like a post 9/11 commission to take up these questions?
Well, a commission to examine exactly what happened would be a great thing, but
in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that progressive Democrats have called for as well. A transparent and clear investigation.
Yeah, because we want to know what happened. Everyone does want to know what really happened. And a good investigation with subpoena powers would be a wonderful thing. I do hope that happens. What we can count on, though, is that any laws passed as a result of this, any expansion of the Patriot Act to go from allowing wiretapping and getting rid of all sorts of due process protections because of foreign threats, any efforts to allow that to also happen to people who are supposedly domestic threats would be a terrible mistake. I mean, it's not hard to imagine, for example, 2 years from now, when Joe Biden, who's off to a great start now, gets embroiled in a war on Iran. He's got very aggressive people appointed now to the Department of State, like Victoria Nuland. It's not at all out of the question that there will be some sort of war activity. And there will be, of course, a violent response to that, any such war activity, because it would be so disastrous, so fundamentally stupid and wrong. And people would say that, and they would attack the policies and the rationales. And I can promise you that if we pass extended laws now allowing for domestic terrorism, there will be efforts, of course, to extend the Patriot Act to say that anybody who opposes our foreign policy is covered. But the efforts to extend have not yet worked out. And if there's domestic terrorism, or straight up make it impossible for people to complain about domestic policy without coming under the eye of the FBI potentially, that would be really bad. And I can promise you that although the far right is in the targets right now, the targeteurs, the FBI, various law enforcement agents, won't keep their telescope there very long, that they're going to extend it to people who may be pursuing laws, in fact, that would attack police efforts to extend their powers, or people who might support efforts to limit police powers, to limit their ability to hide, for example, their past conduct. All sorts of domestic issues arise that people speak really vehemently about, And I can promise you that that sort of activity will be investigated as crimes far sooner and for a more extended period than any effort to right now deal with the far right and Proud Boys and these sputtering groups who have always been with us. You know, what Trump did was enable them to come out from under rocks. But in the 1930s, Father Coughlin had racist, anti-Semitic and broadcasts going on that was enormously popular all over the country. Going back to the Civil War and certainly since then, there's been a strong element of people who feel exactly as do most of the white supremacists who were at the Capitol. To think that we need more laws to control them would be, I think, a really grievous mistake.
Well, then what about existing laws? Because these progressive Congress members made the point in their letter to the House leadership that it's important to recognize white nationalists and QAnon groups as the national security threat that they are and take action to combat them through existing laws, powers, and regulations, which are more than efficient to meet this threat. And it sounds like you would agree with that.
There's plenty of power now to investigate them. That's not the problem. We need no new litigation. I mean, murder is wrong. Conspiracy to overthrow the government is wrong. Conspiracy to break and enter, actually breaking and entering, hitting people, breaking up property. These are all crimes.
But what about, just staying with that point a bit, about what is a crime and what isn't? And aren't there arguments to be made, too, that our existing laws, in fact, that's a big part of the Black Lives Matter movement, are oppressive in many ways, including around surveillance. So is there a false comfort in this distinction between our existing laws and this worrisome or horrifying proposed expansion of surveillance by some of the House leadership?
Well, of course there is. There are extensive laws now. Laws are always being passed to control people who would, quote, overthrow the government. That was the substance of the Smith Act and laws designed to limit the spread of communism. And they all had to do with one's subjective intentions. I mean, to overthrow the government, what does that really mean? I mean, if you're voting for the Green Party, you're trying to replace the government that exists with a different government. It always has to judge criminal law on the basis of subjectivity and intentions is always something that powers that be want, but they should never have. They should confine themselves to actions. Now, if you are planning to blow up a train station for whatever reason, it doesn't matter whether it's a right-wing reason or a left-wing reason, that's against the law. Law that bases itself in part on the subjective intent of someone is a bad law. There are laws like that around still. And in some ways, intent is always a part of criminal law. I mean, did you do so willfully and wantonly? Did you do so with the intent to permanently deprive? Intent is always at issue. You know, did you mean to kill that person? Was it an accident? Or did you plan it for a week?
Does that also enter into the prosecution of cases where some of the right-wing activists claim to have been kind of swept up or responding to the call of Trump and kind of in the surge of the urgency of the moment versus something planned in advance?
Sure. I mean, if you conspired to break down doors and enter the Capitol and kidnap Nancy Pelosi, that's one thing. If you felt like you were serving the wide and broad interests of the millions of people who voted for Donald Trump and have no more general intent than that and want to be part of some sweeping historical moment, that's another thing. So there are issues of intent, but they should be really kept close to the bone. That is, not just broad senses of thinking that if you can prove that somebody wants to overthrow the government, well, you've provided enough intent for some criminal penalty.
What about the rhetorical side of this and how these groups are described? And I think there's been a lot of, I struggle with what to call them. You know, we don't call uprisings in the left and the history of the Black Power movement there. We don't call them riots. So sometimes I think that term can be used probably fairly, but call them uprisings. So your political sympathies do shape how you frame these events. What language would you use? And does it matter whether we, aside from the legal aspects of this, what we call them?
Well, of course it matters. It's entirely political, how you call them. And that's all part of persuasion, of expanding your support. That's an entirely different question than the criminal law.
Right. But I think in that other question, or you can pass on it, whether in the left discussion of the siege on the Capitol, I mean, I've kind of settled on the term rioters, but that also implies a passion of the moment, does it not? And moves you away from the idea of something more coordinated on the part of the far right. So maybe that term also is problematic.
It is, you know, and I have cast about for the right way to call it, but it's like an event.
Capital E, the event at the Capitol, the January 6th event.
J6, you know, J6 is coming to be, you know, more and more widely used. And because it does evade any category. Like, riot implies something that happens when everybody is totally out of control. And it wasn't like that. It was planned ahead. There were exhortations from a wide variety of politicians urging people to show up. And show up, what does show up mean? And there are other people who said, this is ours. We've got to take the Capitol. It's ours. We want it. And but there's a wide swath of these kinds of attitudes that people had, and it lasted for a few hours. In some ways, it was a farce. I mean, it was pretty easily disbanded once the police got their stuff together.
Right, and then it seemed that the level of planning and the more formal organized part, participation of far-right groups kind of emerged later, and I think it's still not entirely clear on that front. But, well, let's continue to follow the event of January 6th as things unfold and continue to talk about how much of a threat the organized far right is, as well as what to be cautious about what we call for, because it can visit upon us as well, come down on our heads as well.
It was a great event in many ways for the Democrats and for the left, because it was a bad intent and poorly executed. But we should not allow this to expand into changing and increasing criminal sanctions for anyone.
Okay, so this is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about calls in Congress for expansion of domestic surveillance and anti-terrorism laws after January 6th, and why we need to resist those calls. So we'll keep following this.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Denise Morris produced today's program. Thanks to all our regulars and their guests, Bill Resnick and Representative Con Pham, an activist leader of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, Chelsea Ratzliff and playwright Tara Hopebringer discussing Hopebringer's new play, Ways of Trying, and finally to our Left in the Law team, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken, for their discussion of right-wing extremism and the danger of creating new laws to combat it. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland.
Good morning, this is Denise Morris with the Old Mole Variety Hour. I want to remind everyone to visit the cleanenergyoregon.org site, where you can learn more about the Oregon Clean Energy Campaign and House Bill 2995. That's 100% clean energy for all bill. Create good, well-paying local jobs in the renewable energy sector that incentivize local projects that are good for communities and reduce pollution by achieving 100% energy as soon as possible. You can find that again on cleanenergyoregon.org. Also, an opportunity to support the struggle to stop Line 3 in Minnesota. Extinction Rebellion US is hosting a screening of Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance that includes a panel of water protectors and climate activists as a benefit to support this mobilization to stop Line 3 in Minnesota. You can go to Eventbrite, benefit screening of the film Necessity, Oil, Water, and Climate Resistance, or follow at Extinction Rebellion US for more information. And I want to remind folks also that playwright Tara Hopringer's new play, Ways of Trying, a solo show about queer love and liberation, premieres on February 3rd at 7 p.m. and is part of the Fertile Ground Festival 2021. For more information, you can go to Fertile Ground Festival 2021. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour, hosted this morning by Tom Becker. We're on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.